In its heart, the state perceives and records, not in units of human beings, but in bodies, categories, classes, groups. One of the most important categories invented by the modern state is the category enemies. Even in its infancy in the 1400s and 1500s, the modern state was ringed about with foreign enemies and permeated with internal enemies, as Machiavelli makes clear. By the 19th century, Western powers had decided that birth in the territories of a different state was enough to qualify one as an enemy. The decisions of the state in whose territories these people had left suddenly defined them in their new home, that is, as enemy aliens. With the outbreak of World War I in 1914, from Central to Western Europe, in North America and in Australia and New Zealand, the fate of a host of people designated as enemy aliens was internment behind barbed wire. That the 20th century added barbed wire to the arsenal conceived of by Machiavelli is a commonplace. Barbed wire has been the indispensable tool of the modern state, from Dachau to Guantanamo. But it's perhaps not so common knowledge that virtually every belligerent power in World War I locked up enemy aliens behind barbed wire in internment camps that ruined individuals and families and blazed the trail for the vast concentration camps of Hitler and Stalin and beyond. Barbed wire, you might say, both focuses and symbolizes the violence that backs the theory and practice of the modern state. The invention of barbed wire in the 1870s opened up whole new vistas for the state. I've written about the invention of the barbed wire concentration camp by the Spanish, British, and Americans between 1895 and 1907 in wars of empire in Cuba, South Africa, and the Philippines. But I recently began working on the next chapter, internment camps of enemy aliens during World War I. Almost everybody knows about the American internment of Japanese in the Second World War, but few are aware of the continuous history of internment from 1914 onward. Today, I will limit myself mainly to the European powers in World War I, indeed, mainly to the Entente powers. You remember who that was. That was the side that made the world safe for democracy. The moment the war broke out in August 1914, the British government targeted resident individuals, entirely legal, who had not applied for naturalization and were aliens. Most of the male enemy aliens in Britain were slated for internment. I will tell something about this program by means of an example. Let us say a German craftsman, a commercial embroiderer, perhaps, moves to England to set up shop around 1900. He does good business, makes a good living, meets an English girl, marries her, has some children. In an age before passports and green cards, he's enthusiastic about Great Britain, but he never sees a need to formalize his status as a British subject. True, the category of enemy aliens exists in law at this point, but it's likewise true that Britain has for a century given up persecuting those resident civilians whose home country is a belligerent country on the opposite side in some war or other. Hence, our tradesman in London goes blithely on without noticing the increasingly careful efforts that European governments are taking to categorize battlefield enemy combatants, to categorize wounded enemy soldiers, captured enemy soldiers, enemy civilians who do what they are told by the invading army, enemy civilians who put up resistance to invaders, etc. There are suddenly rules and identifications for all those categories. Then the war broke out on August 4th, 1914, and by the end of the month, enemy aliens were already being rounded up. Some had already reached the Isle of Man in the middle of the Irish Sea by the end of August. But back to our tradesman, whom I might as well name since he was a real person whose records I looked at in September on the Isle of Man. He was Max Gotshalt, and his wife was named Thekla. That's important. I mean, I will talk about them some more. Gotshalt found himself arrested and transported to the Isle of Man. There were many internment camps in the UK during the war, but the most permanent was the Knockalo camp on the Isle of Man. This internment camp sprang up on pasture land just over a ridge on a kind of cliff overhanging the sea almost. Conditions were rough, wooden barracks, barbed wire enclosures, etc. The wind blowing off the Irish Sea is not known for its warmth. And rations were slim, sometimes extremely slim, and even when plentiful, boring and plain. The existence of enforced idleness was enervating. Thecla and her four children tried to maintain the family business, and Max attempted to coordinate things from Nakhalo, but all communications were by letter. Censors confiscated many of them, so Max and Thecla were never sure which letter had made it. Thecla both took care of the children and tried to run the small embroidery workshop business. No one could predict either the length of the war or the length of internment, so planning was short-term at best. As the war dragged on, Max instructed Thecla to cut corners in various ways, to make specific deals with various vendors and factories, and finally to sell off some of the embroidery machines. By 1917, Thecla hardly had food for her children. She sent a few parcels to Max at Nakhalo, but he always reprimanded her since he couldn't stand for the children to go hungry. Her dealings were triply difficult. Since she was married to an enemy alien, a ruling of the authorities made her an enemy alien too. So English-born, she was ruled to be an enemy alien. She got help from no one. The war ended, but the worst was yet to come. The British government decided that most of the enemy aliens would be returned to their country of origin. Max was among the vast majority who were, going right from the camp directly to Germany. Except that Germany was starving because of the illegal British hunger blockade of all goods throughout the war. Some 800,000 German civilians would die of starvation during the war and its weight. The economy was chaos. There was violence in the streets. The currency was being destroyed by inflation. And Max's family didn't go with him. They were still in England. He wrote a few letters from Germany, but by 1921, he was asking Thecla to avoid describing his family's plight since he could do nothing about it anyway, and he just could not bear to know about it. His letters from Germany stopped coming in 1921, and Thecla never heard from him again. Here is a single tragic experience of a few individuals, and there were millions of such stories in the world from 1914 onward. A short listing gives some idea of the magnitude of the state's internment of enemy aliens and a related but much more useful category that emerged rapidly, undesirable persons. France ran a string of internment camps throughout World War I that, as we'll see, went into the post-war period, both military and civilian POWs, they said. Canada interned thousands of enemy aliens, mainly Ukrainians. Australia interned all persons, citizens or not, who were of German descent. In the United States, with 500,000 Germans and 3 million aliens who came from Austria-Hungary, only those suspected of being dangerous were interned, and about 2,300 were so suspected and ended up at camps in Utah and northern Georgia. Well, the war ended in November 1918, and the camps were slowly dismantled. Families and lives had been destroyed, there were other tragic repercussions as well. The ideas of internment flourished. The Bolsheviks may not have invented the concentration camp, but they employed the example of this mass internment breathtakingly and in extensive ways. And indeed, in the West, the experiment in interning enemy aliens was considered a huge success overall. Indeed, all the powers, all the belligerents in the war prepared to build on their experience so that they could do it better the next time. I am still in the beginning phases of the larger project that I'm working on, but some characteristics of internment are becoming clear. One point seems obvious, but I'd like to state it clearly. The whole process of internment was a process related to war. These camps were invented because of war and inside of war. And the whole progeny of internment camps, concentration camps, refugee camps, all of those would be a product of war, and especially the war of the state against its internal enemies. Another point is that the state tended to recycle its war-related properties. One prominent example of this is the real estate that was the site of the first and most important the first and most important Nazi concentration camp, Dachau. As a developed landscape outside of the town of Dachau, just north of Munich, the Dachau site began life not as an internment camp in World War I, but in World War I as a munitions plant. Hence, it was a place where there was plentiful state investment, there was this war industry, etc. And the land belonged partly to the Bavarian state, partly to the German state. After 1918, the factory closed, and the out-of-work thousands contributed to the highest unemployment of any city in post-war Germany. Indeed, when Hitler came to power in 1933, the first Nazi goal was to identify the enemies of the state and lock them up. The lands of the Dachau munitions plant, long deserted, presented themselves as a perfect solution. Large area, already surrounded by barbed wire, some existing buildings, a huge workforce of guards, plumbers, truck drivers, etc. That was in 1933. Hence, there was a kind of recycling of state properties from munitions plant, in this case, to concentration camp. But these are institutions that are in many ways related to each other. This recycling aspect is important, I think, because for all of the state's inefficiencies, or maybe I should say this, perhaps because of the state's inefficiencies, this recycling has been not only a prominent feature of many internment camp stories, but also a driving force. As in the case of Dachau, the existence of the internment enclosures have also seemed to suggest to the state further internment of this enemy or that. In connection with this recycling process, as I'm calling it, the most striking part of my search has to do with the network of interrelated internment camps in southern France. Much of the original documentation on these camps is either missing or still secret, so my research with these has so far consisted more in establishing a kind of spatial understanding of this network of camps. To do this, I went to southern France, to a region along the Mediterranean, just north of the Franco-Spanish border, in one of the areas pictured a moment ago. It was still Spain back then, but it's in France now. And my wife, Karen, and I visited a number of sites telling the story of this small corner, just a tiny corner, of the very large French internment camp system for enemy aliens and undesirable aliens. We spent much of our time at the camp of Rive Salte, just outside of Perpignan. A military barracks, I should say that this was a camp set up in 1938. A military barracks had already existed from about 1937 when in this camp area. And in 1938, the French began to intern masses of Spanish refugees fleeing Franco's forces. These undesirable aliens were the first internees, but not the last by a long shot. In only a year or so, the remaining undesirable aliens were joined by enemy aliens from throughout France. That would be Germans and others, because the Germans and the French went to war. As in Dachau in 1933, the camp was great for the local economy. Local people found work as guards, cooks, truck drivers, guard tower carpenters, and whatnot, a kind of a French New Deal. But France fell to Germany in 1940, and under the peculiar rules of the occupation regime, the camp began to receive a new category of undesirable aliens, namely Jews on the run from Nazis who made it in some way to France or to some place where they were captured by the French. Also, gypsies were put there, along with the others, many of whom were still there. Both groups, both of these undesirable alien groups, were later transported to the terrible French concentration camp at Drancy, and the survivors thence to Auschwitz. But wait, there's more. Liberation, and these camps revive, no doubt same camp guards, as German POWs are now put there, along with some undesirable displaced persons. But this can only go on for so long, and by 1950, the POWs go home. But wait, there is more. In Algeria, the dirty war happens in the late 50s. France gets out of Algeria. The French settlers, the Pieds Noirs, have a very difficult time coming home, but they're French. Those Muslim Algerians, the Harkis, who were on the French side in the dirty war, fled to France, where else, and where to put them. How about the concentration camp huts at Reef Salt? So from 1962 to 1977, there are families of Harkis eking out some kind of existence there, something like a Palestinian refugee camp. Then that was liquidated. But wait, there's more. French Middle East policy led France to some odd choices. And in the 80s, they pulled a group of Kurdish refugees out of either Turkey or Iraq. Where to put them? Well, you guessed it. So this group was added, and then later some more illegal aliens from the 1986 terrorist swoops that France made. This camp was finally ended, finally relocated, 2007. To conclude, the state invents this institution of locking up large numbers of people. Barbed wire made it all possible in the late 19th century. And the state, in its uneconomic way, achieves this recycling of facilities. Uneconomic, but by a certain logic, adept and inventive. When my wife and I visited the most derelict sections of the Reef Salt camp last November, we wandered around speechless. Desolation all around as far as you could see. Ruined huts with fallen-in roofs, weeds and brush, fallen walls, trash, broken dishes. All of this accompanied by hard, cold November wind and the biting grit that it carried blowing across the dry, brushy terrain. But our major impression was barbed wire, generations of it. From now, from then, from the 20s, all mangled and crumpled together. That internment camp sums up much about the violence of the modern state against its enemies. And the barbed wire is not merely the tool of the modern state. Barbed wire is in its heart. Thank you.